I said to him, look, Michael, how can you say you agree with an Israeli ethno-nationalist for Israel, but diversity is our strength in England, we have to have unlimited migration, British values are what makes you British? And he just didn't address it. He just, like, talked past it. And I kept hammering it. And it's because it's a conversation that nobody wants to touch, because it's a double standard that lies at the heart of our politics since the Second World War. And it's basically another duplicitous sales pitch for why you don't get to have a country, but other people do, and even though it works, you can't have that, but you have to support them having that, and I just can't stand that.
I am again at ARC, and I have a very special guest for you today, and that is the man, the phenomenon. He's blown up in recent years. When I met him at ARC in 2023, he came up to me. I remember you did, didn't you, in the young person's thing, and you were amazed that I was here, that it was based enough. Anyway, he's here now, and that is Mr. Conor Tomlinson. Conor, hello.
Hello, Ed. Thank you for sitting us in a greenhouse where I'm baking to death. I wouldn't do it for anyone else, just so you know.
I normally, chaps, I'm the smart one. Normally there's the cravat and whatever, but I can't tell you how hot it is here today. It's something like 36 degrees. It's insane, and so the nearest thing you can get to freshness is a greenhouse. But Conor has buffed up.
I'm suffering for my art.
Yeah. He's suffering for the art of being a traditionalist for the occasion. So tell us a bit. You've blown up of recent. That, you know, there's been your interview with Liz Truss. There's been all kinds of stuff that you've done since you left the Lotus Eaters. And so how did it start, Conor? Where are you from? Where did you start out?
Okay, so I have to give the Lotus Eaters credit for the Liz Truss interview, actually, because it was on my old show there. The only reason I've, I suppose, blown up is purely by accident, because I was expecting to do a few other things in my departure, temporary departure from Swindon, and some of them fell through. Nevertheless, I've come back to see the lads, so that's nice, and I just accidentally started my my show back on YouTube, and for some reason people want to listen. But as far as starting out goes, I mean...
Let's get back in time. Where are you from?
Grew up in Bexley. Currently living just down the road from the hospital where I was born in the maternity ward, which is now closed down because, you know, decline is everywhere. And dad does HVAC, mum's a teacher. Spent a lot of time on building sites with my granddad. We did up a lot of houses when I was growing up.
What does she teach?
She does like special educational needs and stuff in a Catholic school. And I went to a pretty normal primary school, went to a state grammar. I was one of the catchment area for the grammar was widened out. So you got a lot of kids from the more diverse areas of the borough, and then you got quite a lot of kids from the neighbouring borough, which was Chislehurst, Bromley. They were the rich kids, and I sort of fell in the middle of where most of my family migrated out from the East End, from Barking, Dagenham, Poplar, out to the estates in Kidbrook, eventually went to Bexley, upper lower class, lower middle class. So I didn't really get on with school very much. I found it quite insufferable. I was bored to death by most of the teachers.
Well, you went to grammar school, so
yeah.
You passed your 11 plus.
Yes.
So you're reasonably bright. So why didn't you get on in school?
Sclerotic, stifling intellectual climate, and I was forced to do subjects that I had no aptitude for or interest in. But a lot of the time in primary school, I didn't like a lot of the sit at a desk, work cooperatively, constant chatting. Like, I would sit on my own at the back on a single desk, get my work done relatively quickly, and then just start drawing and writing my own short stories and things like that. And so that mentality, I carried that over to secondary school, but of course, a little bit less flexibility there. And
that's going to get people taking the piss out of you, isn't it? Writing stories at the back of the class.
Yeah, so I enjoyed it. I didn't really take much notice of social dynamics, which meant that I suppose I was a bit incongruous with the groups that formed at school. And there was a bit of factionalism as well. So we had, obviously as a Zoomer, we had a level of diversity in the class. And it was noticeable moving from primary to secondary. Like, primary school was overwhelmingly white British. Secondary school, because the catchment areas were wide, we had quite a lot of kids from Ghana, Nigeria, a few Jamaicans, some South Asians, some Chinese kids, and then a fair few white British kids, and then like Poles and Romanians. And there was a bit of ethnic factionalism where one-on-one you got on with the kids, but then you would get like a black block. The African kids would have banter between each other for the African countries, but then the black kids would be friends together, and then the white kids would be apart. There would be a tiny bit of cross-pollination.
That's interesting, because at my school, at my secondary school, it was so overwhelmingly white. It was Catholic school.
Right.
But there wasn't really the possibility for them to develop clear ethnic gangs. There just weren't enough of them.
It didn't turn violent very often. I think that has changed now. But I do regret actually not going to the Catholic state school rather than the the grammar school, because the standards at the grammar school were terrible, especially when they brought in all of the academy laws and some of the senior leadership, like skimming money off the top, and the behavioural standards were lax, and they were very focused on a breadth of subjects at GCSE so they could sort of tick off all of their Ofsted scorecards rather than focusing on the individual needs of the students. And so I just didn't really like school very much. And I didn't care during my GCSEs. I basically scraped through into sick form. And then at sick form, I did really well in English and drama. And I got an unconditional offer at university. And then I just bunked it in year 13 and didn't really care.
What unconditional offer did you get?
I got to Kent. I went to study English because, again, I was interested in fiction and things like that at the time.
Did you do a really amazing interview or something? How did you manage to get an unconditional offer?
I think it was just my predicted grades, because in year 12, I got something like A star AA or something, and that was a bit above the requirements that Kent had offered.
And you didn't think of going somewhere more, sort of well-known?
Not really. I liked Canterbury and I liked the course that was on offer, I suppose.
So what was it in your GCSEs then that just couldn't be bothered?
So we were forced to take a language, we had to do a fair amount of maths exams, we were forced to do PE, and...
You had to do PE at GCSE?
PE GCSE, exactly. It was mind-numbing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I just didn't enjoy the school dynamic. I didn't enjoy the sort of textbook-style cramming, the read-write-repeat parroting. I didn't feel that there was much room for novel thought or dissent. And so I just checked out mentally, and I was playing a lot of video games instead, so...
And so you were brought up Catholic.
So. Yeah, so I was baptised. We didn't regularly go to Mass until around 2008. So my uncle died hit by a train. We're not sure on why, but it broke the family apart, as one might understand. And my grandparents started going back to church. My granddad got involved with the Catinians, doing quite a lot of charity work in the local area. And my mother...
Catinians?
It's like a Catholic men's fellowship, and they do... annual dinners, they do a lot of charity galas and things like that. It's almost like a Catholic Rotary Club.
Okay.
Yeah. And so my mum started taking us to Mass, and I was kind of an impatient kid because I wanted to rush home and play my DS and my Xbox, and so I didn't appreciate it at the time.
Maternal uncle or paternal uncle?
Maternal uncle.
Okay, so yeah. Her brother.
Yes. Yeah. And he was a great guy. I mean, he sort of... I blame him for my comic book addiction as a teenager, so... You know.
Why did that... I don't mind asking. Why was his death in a train crash, tragic and awful as that is, to tear the family apart?
Well, so we... My grandparents took losing a son very hard, as one might imagine. And so he had... He had schizophrenia for a little while, and it was drug-induced. And so he had quite a few hard years struggling with... mental illness, the family trying to rehabilitate him, and yeah, it was really rough for them. And so I think they saw solidarity and meaning in going back to church.
Right.
And for me, as with quite terrible time dilation as a kid, it felt like absolute eons going to Mass. I didn't appreciate it as I should have at the time, or perhaps it was never really explained to me the value of it, maybe. And so I had my first communion confirmation, and then I just let it lapse as a sort of like 14-year-old. I went for my nihilistic atheist phase. And it wasn't until I went to university and I got engaged in politics, partially because I could, am I right to swear?
Sorry?
Am I right to swear?
Sure.
Yeah, my bullshit barometer went off in various seminars. I started digging into the part of the narrative that I wasn't being told about particular contemporary issues like immigration, counterterrorism, climate stuff, gender, all the race politics, all this stuff that we were getting taught, and I just knew it was bunk. And so I ended up doing like double the course reading as was required, and I would come to a seminar and argue with like 15 of my compatriots and the seminar leader. And in the course of doing that, and this was 2016,
SJW owned compilation era. I stumbled upon Peterson stuff, and one of the most impactful things for a lot of young men was the biblical lectures, which sparked an intellectual curiosity into Christianity as a civilizational meta-narrative. So it was all very theoretical, but part of the reason I started going back to church, and I now consider it a part of my identity, is because I recognise it's a part of our inheritance. Like, we possess it; it's ours. And these fundamentally incompatible, in many cases violent and virile cultures that have been brought into our country, into contact with our civilization, they truly believe what's theirs. And there was something to what our ancestors believed that gave our civilization some vitality to, and it's our inheritance and we should own it. And even if we have some gaps in our understanding, it's more likely that out of humility my contemporary doubts are incorrect than this sort of 1,000-odd years of tradition that's been secret to our success. And so I just decided to start participating in this tradition again. And fortunately, my life has flourished far more than it did when I was a nihilistic teenager playing a lot of video games and not really.
So you were how old when you returned to Catholicism?
About 20.
20. So yeah, 20. So 2018, something like that.
Yes. Yeah.
And was there ever any kind of the religious experience or anything like that that took place?
No, I would say I lived quite a lot in my own head, and it was a I find a lot of women, and also for some reason like male evangelicals in America, talk a lot about their personal relationship with Christ or how Christianity makes them feel, or they have this sort of spiritual connectivity or sense of satisfaction by identifying Christianity. I don't have much in the way of like embodied belief. I don't feel much. It's very much this makes sense. This intellectually corresponds with our morals, our identity, our history, and so it's correct. And it just like logically fits.
Right, so it's a very interesting comment that you made, the idea of having the humility to say that this chain has gone all the way back 1,000 years, whatever, and therefore who it's works and who am I to question it?
Yeah.
So where did that come? You come on a podcast or whatever, you're all confident and whatever, and hello, and you know ripping Catherine Burble Singh apart and all this sort of thing. So that's an aspect that perhaps doesn't come across in public. So where did this humility come from? What was it you were thinking about?
I don't know yet. Maybe I don't have much in the way of understanding external perceptions, but I would say that if I say something on camera, it's because I've thought about it beforehand, and otherwise I'll admit to something if I haven't thought about it, and I'll just say, you know, I'm basically just feeling it out, so you know, don't hold me to it. But maybe my assertiveness on camera, if that's the case, comes from a place of having the humility to know what I don't know, and therefore only speaking on topics that I do know and I'm sure about, so it comes across as if I'm either, you know, confident or arrogant, given the beholder. But I don't know where the humility would come.
Well, where have you been in a situation where it's been a topic and you've thought, I don't know about this, and I'll just say, I can't deal with this topic?
So if I've been asked in an interview about detailed topics about economics, for example, and I'll say, look, here's my general sentiment. I'm definitely, you know, not an economist. I can't just give you policy off the fly. It might be an unsatisfying answer, to be honest. This is my vague feeling about, for example, that our working lives are consuming far too much of our personal lives and it's making everyone miserable. I don't know how to properly reconfigure that. It would be great if we could have single income providers again. We might be able to use technology to reclaim like medieval ways of living, as David Starkey recently accused me. But when it gets into the nuts and bolts of economic policy, I just have to say that's kind of beyond my remit. I'm not excellent with numbers. I'm very much a word cell. So I just have to admit my shortcomings, I guess.
So when you finish university and you do your degree in English literature, and so then how did you go from there to being involved in the Lotus Eat?
Oh, okay. So when we were at university, we had a Freedom of Speech Society. It was a chapter of Students for Liberty. And my friends ran it. One of my friends, Chris Barnard, who is now over in the States and actually speaking at ARC, I think. He did last year, anyway. He set up a society just for debates. So we had Carl over, funnily enough. I didn't meet him at the time, but he was over in 2018. We had the first debate between like an Israeli and a Palestinian ambassador on campus. We had Jacob Rees-Mogg getting heckled about his lack of support for Count Dankula. We had a Brexit panel, all this sort of stuff. And the local Antifa chapter and the University Antifa Society and the Feminist Society and the president and vice president of the student union all teamed up in a group chat to try and provoke fights at the event to get it shut down. They like defaced the side of the sports center with threats, and they got into our group chat and like doctored a bunch of screenshots about edgy jokes, and they accused us of like supporting the Christchurch massacre or something. It was on BBC News. Like, weirdly enough, Rosie Duffield, who was the local MP, decided to attack us, and then of course, you know, eventually the crocodile came for her, so really ironic. But we got put
as part of a struggle session with the university diversity coordinator. And she was saying, look, I've been reading Daily Stormer and the Nazis use jokes to recruit. And so you're using humor to recruit for the Nazis. And we had to sit through there as if this like sheer farce had any legitimacy, because of course they were hanging our university positions over our heads. And so we banded together and like built together a dossier. Callum from the Lotus Eaters actually was at the same university, same society at the time, small world. And so we just presented this, and we got screwed over anyway. Like, some of us got fined, some of them were prevented from graduating. So they tried to ruin our lives as like 19, 20-year-olds. And so we decided to become thick and fast friends. And my friend Chris established like an environmental economics think tank that I did a bit of freelance policy writing for. I
didn't know universities could fine students.
Yeah, they can. Yeah, okay, yeah, for basically transgressions against diversity. So like, there's a few £100 penalty. So like, they're just getting some of their tax money back from like a student loan or something. It's honestly like the process of punishment, right? What they didn't realize is they eventually made some of their worst enemies. So, you know, more for them. But I started helping out my friend with the environmental policy writing stuff, basically just saying, you know, net zero is a farce, and it was all very tepid. But I was doing freelance radio and other writing on the side. Like, I started writing about comics and movies for the American Spectator, not the Spectator, but American Spectator. And I eventually was just doing some freelance bits, and then I got invited on Lotus Eaters, things by John Wheatley, to discuss some novel, and he wasn't in for the day, and instead Callum stepped in and did a podcast about housing, and Carl seemed to like it so much that he just like, oh, do you want to come and get a cup of tea in the office, and just went, turned on me and just went, when can you start? And so I spent every day for about 2.5 years commuting back and forth from Bexley to Swindon. So it was like 2.5 hours each way every day. And
why did you move to Swindon?
Because Swindon's a shithole, and also it's really expensive. And I was living with my parents at the time, saving up. So that's why, you know, I've got a grey patch in my beard and bags on my eyes like a raccoon. I've aged like milk, Ed. But it was well worth it, because I really enjoyed my time there. I think I made some good stuff. I've made lots of friends. Some of the guys came to my wedding, which was wonderful. And then that's why, you know, I've been back and visiting on occasion, because I did miss them despite the journey.
What was the most? I mean, you've kind of essentially on the distant right.
Yeah, I suppose so. I haven't disavowed them yet, you know. I know it's popular.
What's been the most difficult, most challenging aspect of that? Or the most difficult, challenging thing that's happened to you since university involved in this stuff?
There was a pretty rough round of like complete blacklisting that happened late last year as a result of my debate with Michael Gove being hermetically sealed in the vaults of Unheard and The Spectator by Freddie Sayers. And then there was a sort of ubiquitous blackout. Like, I couldn't get published anywhere like I used to. I had a campaign waged against me by Stella Creasy and Stop Funding Hate to blacklist me from GB News. Ian Hislop did the same thing for Talk TV. And then it was just like a whisper campaign going around Westminster just saying, like, don't allow him on this, don't allow him on that. Despite me sort of getting along with people, I thought, pretty cordially, because I like to think I treat people, you know, as I would like to be treated, and I don't endorse any ungentlemanly conduct. So that was rough. It was disheartening in such a way that I was like, oh, okay, every institution is captured, but I didn't really reassess the reasons that I'd been banished, because I just thought, okay, I had the courage of my convictions, I just said things. I didn't go into it anticipating what kind of negative reaction I might get, because if you try and do that, you contort yourself into pretzels.
So what was it that you said specifically relatively recently that was considered so based?
Okay, so I had a debate with Govan Birbalsingh on The Spectator. I had originally organised it with Birbalsingh, basically just saying, look, you can't become English. I don't think your school's going to work. Even if you put in Michaela schools all across the country, if it has the demographics of your school, we're not British at the end of it, right? Like, if it's 100% Indian, but they get an education at the Michaela school, great. We're a country of well-educated Indians, we're not Englishmen. And Michael Gove saw the sort of back and forth online and decided to intervene and offer to host it at The Spectator. And so the conversation ended up being me addressing the fact that he was the longest-serving cabinet minister in the last Conservative government, that he has never accepted responsibility for all the terrible things that he did, helping Deng Sara Khan author a definition of extremism that basically prescribed being right-wing and saying diversity is our strength at the ballot box in 2024. He invited Greta Thunberg to Parliament and gave her a standing ovation. He actually wrote Celsius 77 in the aftermath of the 7/7 bombings, and yet still celebrated Islam being at the heart of David Cameron's government. He walks around saying, I'm the heir to Blair. But most importantly, and I think this was one of the things that really upset the apple cart over at Paul Marshall's favourite media outlet, was that I said to him, look, Michael, I don't understand how you as a journalist at the Times could give a cover endorsement to Yoram Hazony's book. And Yoram Hazony describes himself as an Israeli ethno-nationalist. And he described Yoram Hazony's book about Zionism in the early 2000s as, and I'm going to paraphrase, but it's a near exact quote, this answers the ideological questions of our age. So basically saying it is settled, right? This is the doctrine. How can you say you agree with an Israeli ethno-nationalist for Israel, but diversity is our strength in England, we have to have unlimited migration, British values are what makes you British, Rishi Sunak's English, and he just didn't address it. He just like talked past it, and I kept hammering it. And it's because it's a conversation that nobody wants to touch, because it's a double standard that lies at the heart of our politics since the Second World War. And it's basically another duplicitous sales pitch for why you don't get to have a country, but other people do. And even though it works, you can't have that, but you have to support them having that. And I just can't stand that.
He seems to support all kinds of different contradictory things. So in the early 2000s, he was going to be the editor of a book called Standard Bearers, which was a book of essays by people like Jonathan Bowden.
Yeah, Bowden has an interesting story about him, if I remember correctly.
I don't remember what that story is.
He said he confronted Gove about immigration, and Gove said, oh, it's terrible, it's awful, isn't it? And Bowden said, okay, what, we're going to do anything about it? And apparently, apocryphally, Gove said, we can't do anything, it'd be un-British.
Oh, yeah, so that's right.
Yeah, yeah. And it's true in spirit, if not actually.
Yeah, exactly. But he was involved, really, with these people, like Eddie Butler, who was a British National Party activist, Jonathan Bowden, Adrian Davis, who is a sort of activist on the nationalist right, a barrister, these kinds of people in the 1990s. So I don't know. Has he been on a Liz Truss-like journey? Although, what do you think about that? You interviewed Liz Truss. I suppose you've met her a few times. What do you think of this idea? I say going on a journey is not necessarily a good thing if it's from one thing to another extreme. Like her saying that she was a social conservative, she said that in an interview with Steve Edgington, and he put it to her, well, hang on a bit, you said you were a friend, the greatest ally of the LGBT, and indeed you had an affair, a couple with your husband, so how are you a social conservative?
Yeah, so I would consider Liz a friend. She's been very nice to me, and as far as the journey goes, look, I believe the sincerity of her conversion, though I hope I don't disclose something private by saying this. But a little while ago, we were having a chat, and I just said to her, like, she was trying to build some sort of thing, and she wanted quite a big tent to be in it, sort of across the right. And I just said, look, these people are fundamentally unimpressive, and I can understand why you would want to bring these people into this big tent, have this conversation, but you're omitting certain people and including other people in order to appease the people that want to bring it together. And she just said, like, well, nobody could ever accuse you of being someone who makes compromises, Connor, sort of like a half joke. And I said, yeah, and that's true, but, you know, as your friend, I can tell that you're happier when you're not compromising. And she was pretty happy, actually, in the aftermath of our interview when Hope Not Hate, like, threw a fit and tried to make it, like, a national story during the general election, to the extent where Rishi Sunak and Jeremy Hunt, while he was Chancellor, was asked about it. That's completely absurd. Who the fuck cares during a national election about, like, a 25-year-old interviewing someone on a podcast? Nevertheless, after
yes,
that,
they're wrong, you should be deselected.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it was Jess Phillips and Kay Burley,
and because of your connection to Carr.
Yeah, it was pathetic. And after that, she didn't throw any of us under the bus. And again, we did other interviews. We worked on little projects together. She came to my wedding, which was very, very fun. And I could tell that people in politics are happier when they don't think that compromise is a way of life, and that they have a bit more breathing room and some forgiveness to reassess their priors. And so I would say, I hope I don't speak out of turn, that Liz and I agree on plenty. I think she probably thinks I'm far too rambunctious for my own good. I'm not great at building coalitions. But that's why I think I'm decently positioned to sort of sit outside party politics and beat them with sticks and give them carrots when they do things that we like. And I would say that she's only ever been a considerate and good friend to me, and so I hope that if her political conversion is sincere, which I have reason to believe that it's not, that it has made her an awful lot happier.
Well, that's good. That's lovely. And you've got some happy things coming, haven't you? Because your wife's pregnant with the old twins.
Yes, yeah. They're due. Well, they're meant to be due in November, but it's going to be sort of like second week of October. Yeah. So I'm going to have to soundproof my and lock my studio.
Do you know if they're the same sex?
We find out this coming Friday. We think they're probably not, because they're non-identical, separate sacks, and so the likelihood is 50% likelihood that they're different sexes, 25% boy, 25% girl. So.
Okay, finally, what do you think of it? There's a lot of discussion here at this conference about, you know, the future of Britain, remigration, things like this. What do you think about
restore Britain and that policy of remigration more generally? Do you think that's possible, or do you think it would just more likely just sort of tear things apart?
Well, I think it's necessary, because if you don't, they're going to get torn apart anyway. I mean, the future is either Lebanon or returning the vast majority of people that have been imposed upon us against our wishes, who just don't belong here and never will, back to lands and political systems which better suit them and their interests instead. And I think if you don't do that, there will be... the febrility in the country will build to such a point where, unfortunately, regrettably, violence will be inevitable. We've seen signs of this in Belfast, and of course, you know, the Ulstermen are always the first to kick off. But if you want to avoid that vision of the future, if you want to avoid essentially Algeria, where even though the English character is much more restrained than these places in the third world that practiced decolonization in the 40s and 50s, if you want to avoid scenes where, you know, other people's sacred places are desecrated, burial grounds are dug up, and people are sent home whether they like it or not, and things are very inconsiderate and blanket, if you want to avoid that, you have to do a sort of a targeted policy of citizenship stripping, ensuring all illegals and criminals go home. But also, if you have to be assertive about our culture, and if people are repelled by that, okay, good, you just don't belong here.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And if people want to support you, Connor, your staff, how can they do so? Where can they find you?
Oh, well, I'd appreciate it. It's just my YouTube channel's under my name, Connor Tomlinson. Substack's under Connor Tomlinson or Tomlinson Talks. Post on X at @con_Tomlinson. And thank you, Ed.
Thank
I appreciate
you very much.
It.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much, Anton. Goodbye. All right, great.
We good?
Yep. Very good.
Are you ready for the future of the West?